funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Whatever happened to amateur science? For much of human history, scientific achievements were often the product of careful observation and experimentation by thinkers who may have been obsessed with their subjects, but had not necessarily had a great deal of formal training in them. As the collective scientific knowledge of the human race expanded, along with the role of mathematical equations to describe it all, part-time tinkerers are no longer taken seriously by credentialed experts, but that has not stopped an intrepid few from devising their own theories. In the course of contributing stories about mainstream science to publications including The New York Times, The Guardian, and Wired, Margaret Wertheim has also run across more than her fair share of so-called outsider scientists looking to share very different ideas about how the world works. Her degrees in physics and mathematics make it difficult for her to take their conclusions seriously, but she can't help but be interested in their creativity and drive. She writes about some of them in her new book, Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. Margaret, welcome to Think.
Lovely to be here, Chris.
As a writer who typically covers the activities of establishment science, how did you come to be aware of fringe physics, and when did you actually crack open one of these manifestos and think, I'm just going to take a look at this?
Well, like a lot of scientists, I used to occasionally get these theories sent to me in response to some article that I'd written. And at first I thought it was just an isolated phenomenon, and then they sort of built up on the shelf in my office. And I began to realize that there were quite a lot of these people out there. And then in 1993, I encountered the man who ultimately became the hero of my book, James Carter, who's really what I think of as the Leonardo of the outside physics universe. And he seemed to have such an incredibly elaborate theory that I couldn't sort of put it out of my mind, and I wanted to try to understand, what does it mean that a man in a trailer park feels the need to reinvent physics from the ground up for himself?
And he not only has an incredibly elaborate theory, which is beautifully illustrated, he also, unlike some of his compatriots, has a sense of humor about himself.
Yes, Jim is a very rare case in that he really can kind of have a laugh about it, although he does really genuinely believe that he is not only the new Einstein, but actually the Isaac Newton of our time. He really believes he's found the true foundations of physics that ultimately, you know, the whole of reality is based on. But he has this very whimsical, playful sense about what he's doing. He does these amazingly beautiful illustrations of his ideas, and he makes giant smoke rings in his backyard to test his ideas. And he really has this very sort of, almost in my mind, a 19th century approach to science, which is, as you said in your lovely introduction, it's very much a tinkerer approach. And he sees that, you know, any problem that faces him, whether it's, you know, building a house or finding a meteorite or having his own theory of the universe, that he should, as it were, get his own hands dirty and try it for himself. And so he has this very kind of, really what we call very playful attitude to life in general.
And I suppose that some of this was cultivated even when he was a child, living on the family farm, and things would break down and he would have to fix them.
Yes, Jim grew up on a farm in a place called Buckley, which is just near Mount Rainier, south of Seattle. And so, you know, he was always building repairing machinery as a kid with his father. And by the time he was 14, he knew how to fix a car and get it running. And so he basically grew up with this notion that machines were things that, you know, you just sort of put your hand in and you got them running. And he came to think of the universe as a great machine, which is actually an idea that's been prominent in physics itself for hundreds of years. And he believed that basically the universal machine was not that different to a car. It was something that he ought to be able to lift up the hood and understand the universe for himself.
We'll talk a lot more about Jim later in the hour, but I want to go back to some generalities here. What sort of person, in your estimation, ends up devoting years of effort to developing theories that, for the most part, go absolutely nowhere?
Well, one of the things that surprised me when I did the research for this book was that really these people come across pretty much any cultural lines you can name. Mm-hmm. You know, generalizations generally don't work here. I met one who's a retired California Supreme Court judge, someone who's a backyard car dealer. The biggest category of them tend to be engineers, But I've also, there's a famous Hollywood film editor who has a theory of his own. There are graphic artists, there are doctors. I mean, they pretty much transcend all, you know, some of them are rich, some of them are really poor, some of them have made a lot of money. There's one famous outsider, Stephen Wolfram, who's a very, very rich man who has a software company that produces software widely used by scientists and engineers all over the world. And yet, you know, he has a PhD from Caltech and was a bona fide genius at the age of 19. And then he decided, I'm not going to be in the university anymore. I'm going to devote my whole life to my own theory. So he spent 20 years developing his own theory. The only generalization that I've been able to find is that most of these people are men. There are very few women doing it.
What do you think accounts for that?
Well, you know, in what it is a bit surprising, but I think there are reasons for it. Most, you know, physics is the mainstream physics is the most male dominated of all of the, you know, ordinary sciences. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't, it's not surprising that probably outsider physicists would also be predominantly men. But I think it's, you know, they're even more male than insider physics. And I think it's because a lot of these guys are in at heart tinkerers, you know, like Jim. They're good at fixing machines. They've grown up probably tinkering with stuff with their dads or in a home shop. And so a lot of them do think of the universe as a giant machine that they can fix or at least understand. And I think that women just don't, on the whole, have that kind of tinkering relationship to machinery. I mean, a lot of women do a similar thing, which is handicraft, you know, knitting and sewing and crocheting. But they don't necessarily extend that to thinking of it as a metaphor for the universe as a whole. At least that's the supposition I've come to.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems also in many cases, these people who come up with their own theories are frustrated by this chasm between the conduct of science at the highest levels and the ability of regular people to make any sense out of it whatsoever. And so they create their own explanations, which make as much sense as anything else they've read.
Yes, I think you've put it very well. When I set out to understand this phenomena, really what I want to understand is, why is this going on in our society? Why are all these people feeling the need to invent the universe for themselves or to invent a theory of physics for themselves? And ultimately I came to believe that it's because they articulate, you know, again and again in different ways how frustrated and dissatisfied they feel about the scientific theories that they read about in magazines and books. So, you know, they read things like Scientific America and they read about something like string theory or general relativity, and it just doesn't make sense to them. And frankly, string theory and general relativity are very, very difficult to understand. You know, I've got degrees in physics and mathematics, and I can say I, you know, have to work hard to comprehend what's being said in a lot of science magazines. And, you know, this is my profession. And so I think what they're saying is that we believe that the universe speaks a language that the ordinary person can understand. They believe that in some sense physicists are a kind of elite class who've, as it were, hijacked the discussion about the universe and put it in terms of this really elite, incomprehensible language, mathematics, that almost nobody else can comprehend. And they are actually making a very kind of radical social claim, of a radical philosophical claim too. They're saying the universe actually can be engaged with by people who don't have degrees in higher mathematics.
Somewhere in the book, you make a correlation between what Jim Carter is doing and what Martin Luther did.
Yes. Well, at the end of my book, I try to give some kind of overall historical context to this movement. And it occurred to me after years of thinking about this that really people like Jim are making a claim that, as you say, is very similar to what Martin Luther said in the 16th century. The Martin Luther and the other founders of the Protestant Reformation said that the Book of God should be comprehensible to everybody. So one of the things that Luther did was translate the Bible from Latin into vernacular German so that ordinary people could read it. And prior to that, the Bible had really only been available in Latin and Greek to highly educated scholars, which was a very small percentage of the population. And masses were conducted by the Catholic Church in Latin so that ordinary people literally couldn't understand the service. And Luther said, no, we've got to change all of this. Ordinary people ought to be able to engage in a dialogue with God and read the Book of God interpreted for themselves, so it needs to be available in their language. And in a very real way, I came to understand that these outsider physicists are saying the same thing. They're saying the book of nature ought to be comprehensible to ordinary people. It ought to be engaged with in a language that is accessible to the common man. Now, that's a very revolutionary claim. Whether we accept it, what I think is interesting, is that the claim is being made by more and more people.
Do you also see a link somehow between fringe physics and the rise of certain fundamentalist religious movements that reject modern science?
I actually think that one of the reasons why it's important that we pay attention to these outsider physics people is because I think in a way there is a similarity between them and creationists and fundamental religious people. There is a big difference in that these outsider physicists love science and believe that science is the language of reality, but they're rejecting what they see as a kind of elite vision of science because it's alienating to them. And I actually think that is part of what's driving fundamental religion and particularly creationism. I've encountered a lot of creationists and in my life have made an attempt to really understand why creationism is going on today. And I think part of what's driving it is, again, that people, you know, these people read science magazines or they encounter scientific theories and it literally doesn't make sense to them. They feel alienated and displaced in the world that is described to them through science. And they say, okay, given that I feel alienated by this, I'm just going to reject the whole thing. So I think that it's a very widespread problem in our society at the moment that science is hugely successful, but it's also become more and more complicated and difficult for people, for ordinary people to understand. And so I think it's not surprising that people are therefore turning to other systems and saying, okay, if I can't understand the scientific world picture, where can I find a world picture that makes sense to me, that makes me as a human being feel at home in the world? And I think one of the places people are turning to is religious systems, whether they're traditional Christian fundamentalist systems or various New Age religious visions. You know, I think a lot of New Age mysticism is also, in some sense, in part, a reaction to the mystifications of science.
So, and go ahead.
I was going to say, for me, the big question here is how do we as a society, and particularly those of us who love science and believe in science, how can we respond to this?
Yeah, I was going to say it speaks to a certain sort of existential question for you as a science journalist about, you know, what else you can do to communicate these very complicated things to the people who might consume the products of this science but don't really understand what it means.
Yes, well, I think you put that very well, Chris. And the way that I think of it is this, that I think there are two roles of science in general. One is to produce stuff that works, like, you know, antibiotics and microchips, and we all use those products of science, and what's called the instrumental aspect of science. Mm-hmm. You know, it produces stuff that makes our lives in some sense easier. But there's another role that science has taken on in the modern world, and that is to be our description of reality, and I call this the cosmological role of science. And the description of reality that science is describing is now so complicated that very few people do understand it. And so basically what we're confronted with now is science says, here's a picture of the universe you live in. You as a human being inhabit this world. But most people are saying, well, I don't understand this world. I can't even begin to understand this, you know, 11-dimensional string theory or the tensor equations of relativity or even something like, you know, the theory of evolution. It's actually relatively complicated.
Margaret Wertheim is with us. Her new book is called Physics on the Fringe. We'll be back in a moment, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science writer Margaret Wertheim. Her new book is called Physics on the Fringe: Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Margaret, tell us about the first time you decided to go see Jim Carter in person and what you imagined might come of that encounter.
Well, the first time I went to see Jim, I was actually invited to give a lecture at Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma near Seattle. And I thought that was about, you know, an hour's drive from where Jim lives, so I thought I'd just, you know, stay an extra day and go and visit. And I really didn't know what to expect. But when I got there, whatever I expected, was my sort of perceptions were blown away. You know, he lived in a trailer park, but it turned out that he owned the trailer park and he'd built all the sites himself. And he had a pet swan that followed him around like a dog. He also had a wife and two young sons. And so he was being this, you know, successful husband and father and running this trailer park, which had a community of about 120 people. But he also had this little engineering company which produces this device that he himself had invented for lifting sunken boats that he sells all over the world and sells to people like NASA. And, you know, so all of my expectations of what he might be were kind of confounded. And I thought, you know, this is not only has this guy got a theory of the universe, you know, he's digging secret caves and he's, you know, lifting sunken boats and lifting parts that come off rockets for NASA, and, you know, he's got this kind of incredible potpourri of a life, and I thought, you know, I need to understand this. And I kept going back to visit him because I thought, you know, I'd never met anybody like that. And at first I thought I'd just write an article, but eventually I became so intrigued. What drives a man, you know, in a trailer park to invent his own theory of the universe, that I ended up sort of spending 10 years going back and visiting him and eventually puzzled out the book.
You know, reading about Jim, in some ways, I'm struck by the sense that we might have thought he was truly a brilliant mind had he been born a couple hundred years ago before we knew that everything he believes is nonsense.
Well, you know, Jim basically is, I believe, is very much like a 19th century personality. Yeah. You know, in the 19th century, there wasn't this division between what we now call theoretical and practical science. You know, most of the great scientists, you know, prior to the mid-19th century, they were very capable at building stuff, and they also were very good at theorizing. So someone like Newton grew up building little wooden contrivances and making mechanical models, as well as being, you know, one of the founders of calculus. So, you know, we didn't have this division between some people, as it were, doing the equations and some people are sort of doing the more engineering type functions. And Jim's really very much like that. He really is a tinkerer at heart. He loves building stuff. He can fix it and repair any machine. He built his own house, which is, you know, got a tree growing through the middle of it and used to have grass growing on the roof. So he's sort of undaunted by any practical challenge. And, you know, like the 19th century explorers, you know, he just kind of launches off and does things. You know, he ended up leaving college because he thought it was silly to be sitting around reading books, and he thought he should be going out and exploring the world for himself. So he left college to go and search for this long-lost meteorite that scientists believed had fallen on, you know, Oregon State, and no one had ever been able to find it from its original location. And this is, you know, really kind of the 19th century can do, the world is our oyster, just get out there and do it. You know, I was reminded when I was thinking about Jim, of reading The Adventures of Ernest Shackleton and the early polar explorers. You know, those guys, they had to sort of launch off with a certain amount of knowledge, but really they were going into the wilderness, not knowing what they'd encounter.
So I want you, Margaret, if you will, to describe the key ideas behind circlon synchronicity. And for anyone who's just joining us, we want to remind people that we are describing a fringe theory that is not accepted by science, just so that people don't leap in and think there's a brand new theory out there.
Yes. Well, Jim Carter believes that the whole universe is made up of these little ring-shaped particles that he calls circlons. And I mean, the one way to think of this is, you know, think what a smoke ring looks like. Mm-hmm. So Jim believes that at the subatomic level, everything is made up of these, you know, little smoke ring shaped structures that link together like a kind of subatomic chain mail. And what he's really saying is that he believes the universe is a mechanical system. And basically, most scientists believed that the universe was a mechanical system up until the mid-19th century. So from basically the 17th century on, from the scientific revolution, people like Descartes said the universe is a mechanical system. And up until about 150 years ago, that was a standard view. And Jim's basically saying, I believe that the original scientists of the scientific revolution were correct, and that all of the past 150 years of mathematical physics has been just this abstract rubbish.
Now, he's a family man, he's got friends, but obviously the people around him have had to put up with his attention to these things for a very long time. How do his wife and his sons and his friends view his explorations of his own kind of science?
Well, Jim is very lucky in that I think he has the most level-headed, patient, wonderful woman as his wife. Linda Carter, his wife, is a former social worker. And she's just a woman of almost saintly patience. And I also think that she and Jim have a really great relationship. And, you know, she sees that her man is really passionate about this. She doesn't really understand it, but she trots along to the conferences with him. And she's supportive of his quixotic endeavor. And she quite freely admits she doesn't know how to judge it, but she believes in her man and he believes in his theory.
I love that you point out in the book that you are probably the only person with a degree in physics ever to actually read what Jim Carter has produced.
I'm sure that's true. Jim's been doing, he's actually been working on his physics for 50 years and I've known him for almost 20 years. In the whole time that I've known him, no other physicist has ever read the book. And no other person with a trained, you know, degree in physics has ever read the book. And, you know, you can ask, why is this? And I've approached a couple of physicists with the possibility, would they read and give it some feedback or have a conversation with Jim publicly? And one of them said a very good thing to me. He said, you know, Jim Carter hasn't really spent a huge amount of time reading about our theories and understanding our theories, so why should I spend a lot of time reading his theory? And I actually think that's a very, very good point. All of the outsiders that I've met, you know, they've all know physics to a certain point, but they don't have degrees in physics, and most of them, you know, really haven't spent a huge amount of time trying to understand what the mainstream people are saying. They've looked at it a bit, they don't understand it, and they reject it, which I think is psychologically reasonable. But then they want the insiders to spend a lot of time working through their theories. And I think you do have to say it's a reasonable quid pro quo. If you're not going to spend years studying our theories, why should we spend all this time examining yours?
So just as credentialed scientists have professional organizations, there is a group called the Natural Philosophy Alliance, which brings together fringe scientists. What are their meetings like?
There is a big organization of outsider physicists called the Natural Philosophy Alliance, as you say, Chris. And what's amazing to me is how many members it has. There's now, they have on their database, on their website, they list over 2,100 theorists worldwide. They have 1,300 books in their database and over 5,000 papers. And when you go to their meetings, it's really sort of quite funny because what happens is that basically most of them are waiting for their turn to get up and say, you know, I've got the true and final theory. And so it's a bit hard for there to be a huge amount of, you know, genuine to and fro about the ideas because there are so many different ideas in the room. Now, there's a whole section of them who have a particular kind of theory called ether theories, and they can interact with one another because they at least have something in common. But someone like Jim Carter, who has a completely unique theory of his own, it's a bit hard for anybody else to sort of give him much feedback or input because they basically have their own ideas that are completely opposed to his. So the outsider physicist is in a kind of difficult position because he's a bit of a loner even in his own universe.
So it's like a narcissist social club in some ways.
Well, you know, that's the unkind way of putting it. I don't think that these people necessarily are narcissists. I mean, there are narcissists. There are some narcissists, but my gosh, I've met a huge number of insider physicists
sure,
who are narcissists.
Yeah.
I think really these people, they very much want to understand the universe. They deeply love science and believe that science can tell us about the true nature of reality. And they really want to feel that they understand the world that they live in. And they're very much trying to literally make sense of the world. And it's a frustrating thing when you're an intelligent, smart person and you're presented with a theory of the world in the official organs of our, you know, culture, science magazines, even places like the New York Times. And as an intelligent, thoughtful person who loves science, you say, that just doesn't make sense to me. I just can't understand this string theory stuff. So what do you do? I mean, do you... One possibility is to do what the creationists do and reject the whole thing. Another possibility is to just throw up your hands and say, well, I'll turn away from science altogether, which I think is what quite a lot of people have done. And then there's the brave choice, which is to say, okay, I'll really try to make science work. And I think in one sense, these people do have an enormous amount of courage. I think it takes a lot of guts to say, I'll try and figure out the universe for myself.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Bill in Arlington. Hello, Bill.
Hello. I am loving your conversation, and I am one of those characters that has come up with a theory and have worked with it for a number of years, and it involves applying physics and the principles of physics, specifically energy and motion, to that of human behavior. In fact, while I am listening to your conversation about Jim Carter, when you mention the characteristics of Jim Carter and how he hangs on to his ideas, if I knew that he had a significant other, I could also describe, and you described in the exact same way, the behavior of his wife. One of the things that you shared is that men typically find themselves in this area. And the reason that it does from the physics of behavior is that males typically have a strategic drive that's a little higher than females as a whole. That makes them a little more risk tolerant. So they're a little more visionary. Females are a little more tactical. But of course, we have to have both. What are your comments?
Thanks for your call, Bill.
Well, it's funny that you say this, Bill, because Jim Carter actually at one point published a very small book which put forward his theory about human behavior, and he would completely agree with you. He sees men as being more goal-driven, likely to take risks and more likely to want to, as it were, be leaders in pioneering things than women. So his theory of human behavior would also mesh in some ways with yours.
I want to talk about this, Margaret. I mean, you deal very respectfully with all the fringe scientists that you describe in the book. And as you mentioned earlier, you have a very empathetic sense of why they want to do this. On the other hand, you're publishing in this book and saying this does not correspond. I mean, did you have to convince Jim Carter to work with you in making this book? Or was he delighted that at least he gets real publication of some of his ideas that he would not have had you not been interested?
By the time that I came to write the book, Jim and I had known, I'd known Jim for quite a number of years, mm-hmm. and he and I, we had, you know, become, you know, genuine friends. And he was very accepting of the idea of me writing the book. The hard part came, Chris, when I had to finally show him a draft,
mm-hmm.
and I put that off as long as I could, because for the very reason that, you know, you've identified. I'm not saying he's the next Einstein,
mm-hmm.
and I'm very clear about that in the book. I don't think he's going to win the Nobel Prize. I don't think he's ever have his theories taught in Harvard and Princeton and Stanford. That said, I think he's the most amazing individual I've ever met. I think what he's done is truly inspiring. But it was confronting for Jim when he finally read a draft of the book to see that I wasn't saying, I think Jim Carter's got the true and final theory of the universe.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Amanda in Burleson. Hi, Amanda.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, first I'd like to say that I think this conversation is fascinating. But something that's come up several different times in the conversation, I'm a Christian, but I also am very, very interested in some of the, I don't know if emerging theories is a science and creation is the right way to put it, but some of the less settled theories, so string theory being something particularly that I'm interested in. One of the things that you keep coming up and saying is that, you know, folks don't embrace these ideas because they don't understand them. And I think to a large extent that's true, but also from a fundamentalist point of view or from a conservative point of view, a lot of people don't embrace scientific theories, particularly around evolution or creation or the status of being, because the scientific community typically is a very agnostic or atheistic community. And so I think that there's lack of embrace of these ideas, theories, and hypotheses really is more a reaction to the stance and viewpoints that science is totally agnostic. And for me, scientific theory often coincides very, very well with Christian belief and the idea of an omniscient God. So anyway, that's just my two cents and thoughts.
Amanda, thank you so much for your call. We will. We need to take a quick break here, so we will pause, and then we'll get Margaret's response to that after the break. My guest this hour is science writer Margaret Wertheim, whose new book is called Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, talking this hour with science writer Margaret Wertheim, whose new book is called Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, we heard Margaret from Amanda, who said that she doesn't feel that studying science is in conflict with her Christian beliefs, but that a lot of people of faith feel as though the scientific community is entirely populated by atheists and agnostics. And it took me back when she was speaking to what you were saying about scientists not choosing to read Jim Carter's theories because he hasn't chosen to spend much time with theirs.
The Amanda's point, I think, is a really, really important one. And my first book was, in fact, A History of the Relationship Between Physics and Religion. The book is called Pythagoras's Trousers. And what it really looks at is how throughout the course of scientific history, the development of the science we now call physics has really been deeply precipitated by religious ideas. So the fact that you've got people like Stephen Hawking today talking about the mind of God in his book, his book is The Brief History of Time, which is, you know, an encapsulation of what physicists think about the universe. And he ends it with a discussion about the mind of God. Now, why does he do that? It's because, actually, through 2,500 years of the evolution of physics, there's always been this idea that in some sense God created the universe according to mathematical equations, so that when we find the mathematical relations in the world around us, which is what physicists do, that what we are doing in some sense is reading the mind of God or finding God's cosmic blueprint. So Amanda is right that there are many, many Christians who believe that science and their faith are compatible. And for most of history, that was the case. In fact, it's only a very, very recent historical phenomena, really due to the only dating to the late 19th century, that there's been seen to be a big conflict between science and religion. And it's also very particularly an American phenomena. This antagonism between science and religion doesn't exist anywhere near so deeply in Europe as it does here.
Go ahead.
Oh, so I was just going to say that, you know, I really support what Amanda said, that there is no necessity as a Christian to actually see that there is a problem with science. And in fact, I myself was raised a Catholic, although I'm no longer a Catholic. I was raised Catholic, and we were certainly raised to be very supportive of science.
Can you talk about this? You went to this Natural Philosophy Alliance conference. You also attended another conference on string theory, populated with mainstream scientists. Compare and contrast the two experiences for us.
Yes, a couple of years apart, I had these two bizarre experiences. One where I went to the one of the very early Natural Philosophy Alliance conferences, where basically there was about 30 people in the room, each one like Jim Carter, who was getting up and saying, you know, I've got the true and final theory of the universe, and here it is. And I thought, oh, that was pretty interesting. And then a couple of years later, I went as a journalist to cover the first conference in the new field of string cosmology. So this was the application of string theory to the universe as a whole. And it was the same thing. There were more people in the room. There's about 100 physicists in the room. And each one of them got up and said, basically, I've got a vision of what the whole of the reality could be like. Here's my version of string theory. And in the room were some of the major superstars of physics. There was Stephen Hawking was there, and Leonard Susskind was there, and Paul Steinhardt, these huge names in theoretical physics. So this was, you know, the elite of the physics world. And it was very similar experience to going to an NPA conference, because everybody basically had their own vision of reality. Now, it's true that the string theorists actually did share the fundamental mathematics in common, but with the mathematics, they'd all done their own thing. And it was funny because in the tea breaks at the string theory conference, I would ask various scientists, well, what do you think of the previous talk? And they'd say, oh, it was absolutely splendid. The guy's ideas were brilliant, but there's no evidence for any of it. And I began to realize that what we were doing, we were in this room with people telling these fantastical stories, and they were telling stories based on the language of mathematics, but it was a bit like fairy tales. And it was dazzling and exciting, but it was a bit like being at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. Everyone was telling these elaborate stories about the way the universe might be, and it was a bit like Lewis Carroll. You know, I wondered if I was in Wonderland. It was the most thrilling and exciting conference I've ever been to. But on the way home, I began to realize that physics, at least this high-end theoretical string theory, was no longer about empirical validation, which is what I'd been taught to value when I was a young scientist studying at university. It was all about what elaborate, wonderful tales we could tell in this mathematical language. And I began to realize that physics itself had become a new form of imaginative, speculative literature.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. A comment leading to a question. Years ago, I worked at Best Buy in the TV department, and one day the staff passed around this puzzle. And the puzzle had been published on the Mensa website, and that if you could solve it, you were a genius, you know? And I stepped back from this, and I was struck by how personally people take their relative intelligence to others. And it's not just people working in a television department at a department store. It's people in academia, and those people stand above the rest of us. So my question is, what is it about intellect? You know, you can build up your muscles, you can buy a toupee, but you can't change your intellect. It's sort of you. It's in you. Why do people take their relative intelligence so personally? That seems to be what we're talking about.
I think, Chris, the caller, this is a brilliant and perceptive question. And I think you're getting to the heart of something really critical here, that a lot of people do feel, not just that they don't comprehend science, but it makes them feel intimidated and a bit inadequate, particularly when they see really high-powered physicists talking about theories they don't understand in the language, they don't understand mathematics. And many people, I think, have a sense of a feeling of inadequacy about mathematics based on very early experiences at school when they were told they were a bit of a dummy because they couldn't understand, you know, some basic problem in algebra or later calculus, whatever point it was that they encountered these blockages. And so I think that there is this huge sense that we need to think about in our society of how we can, as it were, overcome this sense of inferiority and inadequacy that a lot of ordinary people do feel in the face of supposedly great intelligence. Now, one thing that I'd like to say about this is that I actually believe that, although there are some people who are natural geniuses, I actually believe that almost everybody has the great capacity to be good at mathematics and to understand a great deal of these subjects if only they had access to a good education. I don't think it's the case that most people are incapable of understanding this stuff. I think we're not all going to be Einstein for sure, but most people, I think, have the ability to comprehend this stuff if there was a really good education available to them. So I think one of the problems surrounding this whole subject is that our educational system does not allow most people to get a good grounding in science or mathematics, and that if we really care about having science accepted in our society more widely, one of the things we need to do, in my view, is to put a huge amount more money into proper science and mathematics education.
We have an email here from Leslie in Arlington who writes, I heard an interview of a physicist once who explained that the science curriculum in public schools is backwards and that physics should be taught in elementary school since it is the basis for all other sciences. And she'd love to hear your response to that.
Well, I think it would be marvelous if basic physics principles were taught in elementary school, and I think they could be. When you read accounts of people like Newton and Galileo, you know, all the great pioneers of science and even contemporary great scientists, they're all, you know, at primary school tinkering and bouldering and soldering and working with electric motors as very young kids. And so I completely agree. Again, I think it comes back to how much does our society want to support good science education? You know, pay science teachers properly, support them in the classroom with equipment and labs. And I really do think that the fundamental issue here is that most people in America today are not getting a good science education.
Even while the book is, of course, an endorsement of what we would call mainstream science, it's also a great reminder that what we consider now settled science could someday be considered fringe. I mean, talk about some of the ideas that are now considered ridiculous that at one point in our history any educated person would have believed.
Well, a very fundamental idea that we now consider ridiculous that was absolute orthodoxy until 150 years ago was the idea that the universe was a machine.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Descartes and Newton certainly believed that the universe was a machine. And as late as the mid-19th century, the great genius James Clerk Maxwell, he spent a lot of time trying to develop a mechanical theory for electricity and magnetism. And he's the person who is a precursor to Einstein. But now we think that's ridiculous. The universe isn't a machine, and that's childish nonsense to think of it as being like, as it were, a giant version of your car.
Have you, since the publication of the book, received a greater number of these manuscripts than you received even in the past?
I am definitely being sent more manuscripts, Chris. And definitely the outsiders, I've had quite a few emails from various outsiders, people who've got their own fringe theories. And the response has been interesting because some of them are really pleased that I'm bringing attention to this subject and having it discussed publicly, which is what I was hoping to achieve. And some of them are very upset because I say openly, look, I don't think any outsider that I've met is ever going to win the Nobel Prize. And they're upset by it. Some of them are upset by that because they think that one of them is going to win the Nobel Prize. And so it, part of the thing that, you know, becomes a bit problematic here is, or it's just interesting, is how do we as a society decide which theories we're even going to begin to pay attention to and work out whether, is this one worthy of a Nobel Prize or not? Now, I don't personally think that any outsider I've met is likely to win the Nobel Prize, but who knows, there might be one out there who just might.
Well, let me ask you this. You have a stellar reputation as a science journalist. Was there ever a point during this project when you thought, I can't tell my colleagues that I am reading these things and paying attention to them for fear that they would misunderstand the intent of the project and think that you had sort of gone over the edge?
Absolutely, Chris. This was an issue from day one.
Uh-huh.
Most of my friends who were scientists or science writers really thought I'd gone off the rails taking on this project, because the mainstream attitude to this is, oh, those people are cranks, they ought to just, you know, stop it. And I just thought that was an inadequate response. I thought there's, you know, I'd come to understand that there was just an awful lot of these people, and I thought it was a sociologically important topic to explore. What does it mean that these people are doing this? What does it say about our society's relationship to science, that so many people who love science are in some sense rejecting the mainstream? But it was a fairly, for me, it was a huge professional risk to do this book. I felt there were times during the writing of it where I thought to myself, oh my gosh, have I completely scuttled my credibility by doing this?
That has not been the response to the book, though. Am I correct?
No. I mean, I was in some sense really scared about mm-hmm. how would people read the book. But the response has been wonderful. And I think what people see is what you've seen, that the book is respectful about these people without in any way trying to say, you know, they ought to be taught in Harvard or Stanford, but saying really respectfully, what does this mean? Why are they doing it?
Do you think we'll see more of this as science becomes more complicated for the average person with just a basic education?
I believe we're going to see a lot more of it. I mean, if you look on the website of the Natural Philosophy Alliance, I've been following the organization pretty much since it was founded. And, you know, they started off with just a few dozen people. And now when you go on their website, there's over 2,100 theorists listed. And every month, the number goes up and up. So there are more and more of these people. Their conferences get bigger in number. Their memberships get bigger in number. So this is clearly not a phenomenon that's going to go away. Well, it's not going away, and I don't believe it's just going to go away. I think that there is going to be a lot more of this.
Margaret Wertheim's new book is called Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. Margaret, it's been a great discussion. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It's been a pleasure, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.